Lecturess 34, February 25th, 1963, Paramagnetism and Diamagnetism. Lecturess 34, February 25th, 1963, Diamagnetism and Paramagnetism. Lecturess 34, February 25th, 1963, Diamagnetism and Paramagnetism.
Takes time, right. Sorry. Sorry. No, take it away. Yeah, sorry. Gentlemen, I apologize for all the confusion. Today we're to talk on the magnetic properties of materials. The most striking material which has magnetic properties is, of course, iron. The character of the magnetism of iron is shared also by nickel and cobalt, and at sufficiently low temperature, namely below 16 degrees Kelvin, gadolinium, plus a few peculiar alloys. That kind of magnetism is called ferromagnetism, and it's sufficiently striking and complicated that we'll discuss that in a special lecture. But the average ordinary substance does show some very tiny magnetic effect. Although it's usually said that magnets only affect iron and so on, that's just the gross phenomenon. A ferromagnetism is thousands of times, or almost a million times, stronger than the ordinary magnetism that we're going to describe today. That is to say, the magnetism of other substances other than the ones I mentioned as being ferromagnetic. That small magnetism has two kinds. Some materials are attracted by magnetic fields, and others are repelled. There are two signs to the magnetic effect. Unlike the electrical effect, where the dielectric constant is always greater than one, there are two signs for magnetism. Let me first illustrate this. I have here a magnet with a sharp pointed pole piece and a flat pole piece, so that the field is very much stronger near the pole piece. And that means that substances are either attracted into a stronger field or repelled from a stronger field, depending upon the character of their reaction. And could you get this? I can't make an arc work. We have put between these pieces, hanging between these pieces, a little cylindrical piece of bismuth. Bismuth is one of the substances which is repelled, as you see, from the point by the magnetic field. And it's one of the substances which is, strangely, one of the strongest of all the diamagnetic materials, although it's extremely weak. I must remind you that the diamagnetism is very weak. And doing the same experiment with another non-magnetic substance, to speak roughly, that is not iron and cobalt and so on, we have here aluminum. And I don't know if it's adjusted well enough, but let's see if we can see it. No. Yeah, it's slightly pulled, but it's leaning against the pole piece. So I better move around a little bit. There's not much room to adjust this crude apparatus. All right, now I hope it's swinging freely, more or less. If it would stop, we could tell which way it would move when I close the switch. It stopped vibrating. Now it's against the pulpy, so how can you tell if it's attracted? Well, we'll try once more. No. It's attracted when you turn it off for a reason which I don't know offhand and I haven't got, can't figure out fast enough to explain. Yeah, eddy currents. Which sign should it be, the force? All right, now, by golly, it ought to do something. Well, it's attracted now. I don't know how. Anyway, whatever it is, it's very weak. And there are two kinds of substances. Those are which are weakly repelled, and those which are slightly somewhat more attracted. And I want to describe the mechanism of these two things here. I may say, just to briefly summarize the general facts, it's the following. that in many substances there's no permanent magnets inside, that it, or all the magnets have been balanced out, the electron spins and orbits and so on, all exactly balanced out, so any particular atom has no average magnetic moment. Under those circumstances, it turns out that when you put on a magnetic field, little extra currents are generated inside the atom by Lenz's law, which oppose the increasing field to a slight extent, and thus keep the field down, and they go the opposite way of polarizing atoms. Another electric field will pull the thing, but a magnetic field induces a current which opposes its own field, and those are the diamagnetic substances. Then there are some substances for which the atoms have a permanent magnetic moment. So beside the diamagnetic effect under those circumstances, there's also the possibility of lining up those moments. That is, it's like if permanent dipoles in the case of electricity, which get lined up, so the magnets get lined up, and the magnetism is then induced in the same direction as the field, and that's the form of paramagnetism. The paramagnetism is relatively weak because the lining up forces are relatively small compared to the thermal motions, which try to disarrange the order. And so the result is that paramagnetism, with one exception in the metals, which we can talk about later, which is hard to understand, but it's all regular paramagnetism is sensitive to the temperature, and the higher the temperature, the weaker the effect, the lower the temperature, the stronger the effect. That is, the lining up forces can oppose, as opposed by the deranging forces of the temperature. While diamagnetism, this Lenz law business, is more or less independent of the temperature. Of course, in any real substance with dipole moments, there's both the diamagnetic effect as well as the paramagnetic effect. But the paramagnetic effect is usually much greater than the diamagnetic effect. It is also possible to get the analog of ferroelectricity, in which the dipoles all line up and lock each other together. If you make calculations of how this should happen, you'll find that the magnetic forces are so much smaller than electric forces that the temperature irregularities would knock this alignment off in only a few tenths of a degree or less, hundredths of thousandths of a degree temperature. So therefore, it would be impossible at room temperature to have any lining up of the magnets. On the other hand, we do have iron, and that is exactly what happens. It does get lined up. There is an effective force between the spins of the magnet, magnetic moments of the different atoms of iron, which is much, much greater than the direct magnetic interaction. It's an indirect effect that can be explained only by quantum mechanics, and is 10,000 times stronger or more than the direct magnetic interaction. And this is what lines the thing up in the magnets of ferromagnetism. So it's not the direct interaction, and that we will discuss next time. But I wanted to make a quick outline of the general phenomena. Magnetism, that is, these magnetic effects of materials, are completely quantum mechanical phenomena. It is impossible to understand them from a classical point of view in any honest way. It is, however, possible to make classical arguments and to get some idea of what might happen. One might put it this way: you can make classical arguments and get guesses as to the behavior of the material, but it's not legal in any sense, because it is absolutely essential that the quantum mechanics be involved in every one of these magnetic phenomena. On the other hand, there are situations such as a plasma or lots of electrons in a region of space, where when you put the magnetic field on, the electrons are moving around, do obey the classical mechanics accurately enough, and so under those circumstances, some of the theorems from classical magnetism are worthwhile. Secondly, for historical reasons, the classical arguments are of some value, because what is historical reason? I mean, the first few times people were able to guess at the meaning and behavior of the magnetic materials by classical arguments. And finally, as I already illustrated, it's useful to get some guess, it might be useful to get some guess as to what would happen from classical mechanics. The honest way to do this subject is to first learn quantum mechanics and then to understand the magnetism in terms of quantum mechanics. On the other hand, there are lots of regions that are sort of in between, and if you don't want to get into the involved in the quantum mechanics, we don't want to wait so long until we learn the quantum mechanics inside out to all understand a simple thing like diamagnetism. we will have to lean on the classical mechanics as kind of half showing what happens, realizing, however, that the argument which is made is illegal. I therefore make a series of theorems about classical magnetism which will confuse you because they will prove different things. And every one of them is wrong except the last proof. But they're wrong in the case of the physical world because the quantum mechanics affects that. Now, the first thing that's interesting in classical mechanics is the following, that if we have an electron going around a nucleus, say, in an orbit, or going in any other circular orbit due to any kind of central force, by that I mean going in a circular orbit, but you can generalize this for yourselves. I'll just take the simplest examples. Then this first theorem, which we're going to prove about classical mechanics, is that there's a definite ratio between the magnetic moment and the angular momentum. Let's call J the angular momentum in the orbit. And the angular momentum is the mass of the electron times the velocity times the radius. That's mv times r. That's the moment of the momentum. On the other hand, the magnetic moment of the same orbit is the current times the area, if you can remember facts so far, of an orbit. And the current, when a charge Q is moving around the circuit, is qv over 2 pi r. For some reason, which I sometimes can understand and sometimes cannot understand, this is the current and thing going around the circle. I think you count how much charge passes an area per second. And in 1 second, the charge moves a distance v. That means it passes this region, v over 2 pi r times in that second. So this is the amount of charge that passes an area per second. Multiplied by the area, pi r squared, gives us Q over 2 VA. If it's VR, non-relativistically, of course. This is all non-relativistic. And most of the atoms, by the way, and the atoms are close to being non-relativistic. They have velocities of only that correspond to V squares over C squares of the order of 1%, 1 over 137 of that order, well, 1%. So we take non-relativistic approximation, and we find that these two are proportional. It doesn't depend on the velocity, and it doesn't depend on the radius, that the magnetic moment is equal to Q over 2m times the angular momentum for an orbit motion. That's what we would expect classically. And miraculously enough, that's also true quantum mechanically. That's one of those things which you feel, well, classical physics understands it. But it's unfair. Because if you kept on going with the classical physics, you find something else that it disunderstands, that it understands wrong. And that's a great game to try to remember which things is right and which things are wrong. This is true in quantum mechanics for orbital motion. I might immediately say, while I present this to you, what is actually true in general in the quantum mechanics. First, that's true for orbital motion. But that's not the only magnetism that there exists. The electron also has a magnetism of its proper motion on its own axis, something like the Earth rotating on it, something like, hardly like, because it's so completely quantum mechanical, but like the Earth rotating on its axis, has its own spin, and it has its own magnetic moment as a result of that spin. For an electron spin, the mu comes out to be twice as big, the ratio of mu to J, for the spin motion of an electron. Only for an electron. Generally speaking, then, in any actual atom in which there's several electrons and there's a combination of various things which build up a total angular momentum, if J is the total angular momentum, the right formula is that mu is proportional to J. That's definitely true and guaranteed absolute and cannot be destroyed. But that the proportionality constant is 2 or 1 is not necessarily true, because there could be a mixture of the angular momentum contributed by the orbits and by the spins. And so there's a certain factor in front which is not 1, which is called g. And g equals 1 for an orbit and 2 for a spin, and other values in between or otherwise for other cases. But the classical, well, that is generally so. Now, it turns out you might be interested, just to finish off, what happens in nuclei. In nuclei, we have protons and neutrons moving around, and we again get a formula of the same type. What do you mean? There's no formula. If you write this formula down, there's no formula except to say that the magnetic moment is always proportional to the angular momentum. That's the fundamental fact that can be saved. The combination Q over twice the mass is a dimensionless parameter. And if it's for atoms, it's if the mass of the electron here, then the order of magnitude of the coefficient is of the order 1. And in the same sense, in nuclei, if you put here the mass of a nucleon, say the proton, then the magnetic moment of a nucleus is some nice number, pure number, times the angular momentum times Q over 2mp. And these Gs are different in different nuclei and different in different atomic systems. It's 2 for an electron, 1 for an orbit. For a nucleon alone, it's not 2. It's 2 times 2.79 for a proton. And even the neutron by itself has a magnetic moment, 2, and its magnetic moment relative to its angular momentum is 2 times minus 193 for a neutron. A neutron, in other words, is not exactly neutral in the magnetic sense. It's like a little magnet, but it's got the kind of a magnet that a rotating charge would have of negative charge. Now, one of the consequences of having the magnetic moment proportional to the angular momentum is that the magnets in a magnetic field will precess classically now, if we argue classically. Suppose that we have here the magnetic moment mu. And if here's a magnetic field, then there's a torque on the thing, which is equal to mu cross B, or B cross mu, or something. As usual, I don't know the sign. But never mind the fancy business. There's a torque. If this angle is theta, there's a torque mu B sine theta. That's the torque. Now, the torque makes a rate of change of angular momentum. This is trying to be pulled in. And your first inclination is sure, so it moves up. No, it doesn't move up because it's also got angular momentum along this axis, and is it a great gyroscope? It's just like a gyroscope. What's that doing? It's like a gyroscope and precesses. As a consequence of the torque, the net resulting motion could be a precession around this axis at a certain angular velocity. Let's call omega sub p the angular velocity of the precession. So that in the time delta t, the axis j is moved from here to here, where this angle is, or distance rather, is omega p delta t. And, well, the change in this vector, which is this distance, the times j sine theta. That's because this radius here is j sine theta. So the rate of change of angular momentum is omega j sine theta. This is the rate of change of angular momentum, and this is the torque. And when you set those equal, you see that the sine theta goes out, and we find omega pj must be mu b. Now we have that mu is proportional to j, and so we would have a definite rate of precession, which is the ratio of mu to j multiplied by b. And it comes out as follows. If I will put the numbers in here, and put mu equals this chunk times j. I can simplify the formula, not complicate the formula. But the result is this, that the frequency of the precession, not omega, but 2 pi or something, the frequency of the precession in megacycles comes out to be 1.4 times g, depending on a g value, multiplied by the b in Gauss. For electron system. And the FP in kilocycles, just convenient things to know if you want to estimate what's going to happen, is 0.76 times the G times the B in Gauss for nuclei. Now, why should the formula be different for nuclei than for electrons? Because this is a general formula. And the answer is merely this, that the definition of G is completely different than the two. One is a G is measured in the units of magnetic with an MP and the other ML. And the difference of these is just the 1836 or 8, whatever it is, which is the ratio of the mass of the proton to the mass of the electron. It's just a crazy system of units. It's just that people like to define things in terms of this G, and in which case you have these results. The classical theory is that the orbits will precess. It turns out that this is, you say, is it true or not quantum mechanically? It's essentially true. The meaning of the precession is different. You can't talk about the direction of the angular momentum and so on in the same sense. But nevertheless, there is a very close analog of the phenomenon, so close that we continue to call it precession. But we'll discuss it later when we come to talk about the classical the quantum mechanical point of view. That's the first theorem, then, is that mu is proportional to J with this coefficient. It's modified in quantum mechanics to a new coefficient. So that's wrong, in other words. The second thing has to do with diamagnetism. It can be demonstrated in several ways, but one of the nice ways is the following. Suppose that we turn on the field slowly on an atom. We build up the magnetic field. Then as the field is changing, if we measure around the center of the atom here, let's call that zero point, the symmetry point, then there will be an electric field generated because the field is changing by the Faraday law. And since the field that's on here is changing, the electric field will have a circulation, and we'll put a torque on the electrons which are in the system. And the torque which is put on is equal to the electric field times the radius times the charge. Now, you know that the electric field at a given radius has this property that 2 pi r times the electric field is the rate of change of the flux. This is the circulation, this is the curl integral. And this is the rate of change of the flux of B. So therefore, there's a torque, which is a rate of change of angular momentum, given like this. Well, I can integrate both sides of this and find that the excess or the change in angular momentum, the excess angular momentum, which is induced when you turn on a field, is equal to, by integrating this thing, B times R squared Q over 2. Now, when we have this extra angular momentum, this twist which has been given by turning on the field, this extra angular momentum over and above whatever other angular momentum there may or may not have been there, this extra angular momentum makes an extra magnetic moment. Because this is an orbital motion, and an orbital motion in the classical theory, it says that the magnetic moment generated is Q over 2m times the angular momentum. So this is an excess, a change in magnetic moment for any single atom, which is equal to BR squared Q over 2 times Q over 2m. And if you chase it around, you know Lenz's law has a sign that makes it that it tries to oppose the field. And if you kept track of all the signs, the magnetic moment would oppose the field. For definiteness, I would like to write this formula just a little bit differently, because it turns out that this R that we've been thinking about here is only R squared, is only X squared plus Y squared if the field is in the Z direction, because it depends only on the distance of way from the axis, if you think it out again. It's not the true radius squared, three-dimensional square. But for spherically symmetrical atoms, which is the best ones in the world, if they're not, you're lucky that you happen to put the B along the axis of the atom. So suppose we take spherically symmetrical atoms, then this thing, if I put X squared, Y squared, and Z squared, I would put 3/2 as much down. So if I multiply by 2/3 and change therefore the 4 to a 6, we find the following formula, Q squared over 2m over 6m times the mean value of X squared plus Y squared plus Z squared for the orbit multiplied by the magnetic field. So we have a moment that's induced which is proportional to the field. And that's the characteristic of magnetism, that there's a moment induced proportional to the field. The reason that there's a force and so on, we work out later in terms of the effect of the field on this moment and pulling the samples into the magnet. Or you can work it out from the point of view of energy, find out how much energy there is in this moment in that field, and show that by moving away, you decrease the energy of the system. So that if the sign is negative, it's repelled by a region of strong field. Now the problem is, what is the mean square radius of an orbit? And the classical mechanics cannot supply any answer. And so we have to have the quantum mechanics. So the right answer is true. This happens to be right for some strange reason, because the classical argument is illegal. But if you take the average of x squared, y squared, and z squared suitably defined, that's not so hard to define. It's just the mean square r. You see, in an atom, we can't say where an electron is. We can only say it has certain probabilities of being in different places. And if we calculate the mean square distance from the origin with the probability distribution in an atom, this formula works for the contribution from one electron in an atom. This must be summed over all of the electrons and then multiplied by the number of atoms per cc before we get the magnetic moment per cc. But I'm not worrying about such technicalities now, because we want to understand the machinery, not how you multiply by the number of atoms to get the amount of moment per unit volume and so on. So what shall we say about this formula? Is it true or false classically? Well, in a certain, this classical derivation is true in the sense that the final formula happens to be right at this stage. I mean, that this is right for the quantum mechanical system. Incidentally, this kind of effect occurs even when there's a permanent moment. It's an excess moment. And it's when the system is precessing, say. If you take the other case where it's precessing, the whole orbit is turning, and that angular velocity, that slow turn, represents another current and represents a correction to the magnetism, and that's already included. That's the diamagnetic thing represented just another way. So you don't have to worry about that when you're all about the paramagnetism. You have first the diamagnetic effect, and then you make the thing precess. And don't worry about the fact that as it's precessing, there's an extra little current from the precession, because that's been already included in the diamagnetic term, if you've worked that out first. Now there is some, both of these things, from these things we can deduce some. First of all, in the classical theory, no matter where the moment and J were always proportional, there wasn't any spin of the electron, and the constant of proportionality was always the same. That is to say, in this formula here, there was no G. The ratio of mu to J was independent of the motion, the orbits, and everything. This means that according to the classical theory, no matter what kind of a system of electrons we were to have, it would precess at a certain definite angular velocity, always the same, no matter what the kind of atom. Of course, you know, in quantum mechanics, it isn't true. But it's curious that it's true in classical mechanics. And so I would like to prove that theorem, which is the following, that if we have a system or atom with a central force in the middle, like a nucleus, or any other model, with the electrons can interact with each other, but there's one center that holds the whole thing together. That if you will find a motion of this thing and then put a magnetic field on, you'll find a solution with the magnetic field, a solution with the magnetic field, is a corresponding motion but rotating at an angular velocity omega p for g equal 1. That isn't the only, there are a lot of solutions and lots of motions, but the point is that for every motion without the magnetic field, with the magnetic field turned on, there's a corresponding motion in which the same thing is turning. I'd like to illustrate how such a thing can be proved and leave you to work out the details. This is called Alarmer's theorem. If there's a magnetic field present, the rate of change of mv with respect to time is equal to q times v cross b with a constant magnetic field, plus and minus signs, I don't remember. Now, in a rotating system, if we look at a system, in a rotating system, we can say the rate in a cohort where there's no forces, plus the central forces that there may be, whatever electrical attraction to the center there is. Then according in an ordinary system of coordinates not rotating, that would just be the central forces without the magnetic field. But suppose we looked at the same equation in a rotating coordinate system. Then there will be pseudo forces involved in the fact that we have a cockeyed coordinate system. First, there will be the centrifugal force, things like omega squared r, but r is the radial distance from the axis of rotation, sometimes m. But then you remember there's also a Coriolis force. You may not remember, find it in the notes somewhere, way back in year one. I think it's 16 or 19. My memory fails me. I looked it up, but I have forgotten where it is, which chapter. It's either 16 or 19 as far as my remembrance goes. There's a force due to the Coriolis force, excuse me. That's 2m omega cross r in addition. That's the force that we talked about when you run along the radius in a carousel while you get thrown to one side, and that's it. Now suppose that we take the case of very weak fields in first approximation to the field and very small omegas. Then omega square is negligible compared to omega. And you see then the very simple principle that a rotating system behaves the same as a system in an external field in the first order in the angular velocity, provided that the angular velocity that's used is equal to qb, that 2m times omega is equal to qb, which is the same formula as we have over here, because in this formula here, in the classical theory, mu over j is q over 2m. So this is Larmor's theorem. The only thing I could ask you to improve on is to take the case of many electrons mutually interacting with each other, all in the central field, and prove the same theorem. So that no matter how complex an atom is, if it has a central field, this theorem is true. And that's the end of the classical mechanics, because it isn't true, in fact, that the things do not process in that way, in general, because they have these other values of g. Yes, I want omega cross v, thank you. Right. The force depends on the fact that we're running along the radius and it doesn't where we stand. Now I would like to demonstrate that according to classical mechanics, there can be no diamagnetism and no paramagnetism at all. You say, you're getting me crazy. First you prove that you get paramagnetism, diamagnetism, so on, precessing orbits, all kinds of things, and now you're going to prove that you get nothing. Yes, sir, I'm going to prove that you get nothing. I'm going to prove this because I want to show that if you follow the classical mechanics out far enough, or if you start a classical mechanical argument in a certain place and don't go far enough, you may get an answer of any kind you want. Compare experiment, and the answer is the thing is wrong, the theory is wrong. And so I will prove now that there is no magnetic effect whatever. This is a legitimate and correct proof. It is true that as a consequence of classical mechanics, if a gas or electrons or protons or any kind of a system is kept in a box so that it cannot, the whole thing can't turn. That is, if you have a ball like a star all held together by itself and you put on the magnetic field, the whole thing will spin, then there would be a magnetic effect. But if you have it, a gas in a box, or you have this kind of an experiment where you have a little tube held on by a string, it isn't going to spin of its own, you hold down the spin, then there will be no magnetic effects. This business of holding down a spin is summarized this way. At a given temperature, we suppose that there's only one state of lowest energy. See, when there's spin, there's one state of thermal equilibrium. When there's spin, there's a whole lot of states of different angular momentum, which are all in thermal equilibrium, but we disregard that case. So suppose there's only one state of thermal equilibrium at a given temperature. I will now show this, that if you turn on a magnetic field and wait for the temperature to come back to its original value, there will be no magnetism, para or diamagnetic. There'll be no induced magnetic moment. Proof. According to statistical mechanics, and it's legal, if this part of the argument is right for statistical mechanics, the probability of any motion is proportional to the energy of that motion over kT. Now, what is the energy of motion? I say that for a particle moving in a magnetic field, a constant magnetic field, that the energy is the ordinary potential energy plus mv squared over 2 plus nothing for the magnetic field. You know that the forces from magnetic fields is q times e plus v cross b. And so the rates of working when a change of velocity, which is f dot v, is q times v dot e, and is not affected by the magnetic field. So that if I integrate an equation like this, on this side I get kinetic energies, and on this side I get changes of the ordinary potential energies with no contribution from the magnetic field. So the energy of a system, whether it's in a magnetic field or not, is always given by the kinetic energy plus the potential energy, non-relativistically. Therefore, the probability of any motion which depends only on the energy, it depends only on velocities and positions, is the same, whether or not there's a magnetic field. Therefore, in thermal equilibrium, I have a system in a box here, and then I have another system in a box here, but with a magnetic field, then the probability of any particular velocity in this box at any point is the same as the one in this box. The probability of finding particles in this box is at given places is the same as the probability of finding particles in the other box, and so on. And if the first box has no average circulating current, which it will not have, as a matter of fact, as you would guess that it would have, because which way would it be? Which way should it point? So on the average, there's no magnetic moment in the first box. There's no magnetic field, and there's no magnetic moment. And so therefore, since the second box, all the motions are the same, there's no magnetic moment. Hence, if the temperature is kept constant and thermal equilibrium is reestablished after the field is turned on, then there will be no magnetic moment induced by the field. End of classical mechanics, because there is, we saw it. So I have, therefore, to deal completely in the quantum mechanics in order to get a thorough understanding of the phenomena. We cannot do that now. We do not have a thorough understanding of the quantum mechanics. So this is hardly the place to discuss the matter. On the other hand, we don't always have to learn something first by learning the exact rules and then by learning how they're applied in different cases. We've started off every subject that we've taken up here, we've taken up in a different way. In the case of electricity, we wrote the Maxwell equations on page one and then deduced everything. You think, well, that's the way to do everything. Maybe so. But we're not going to write the quantum mechanic equations on page one and deduce everything. We're going to tell some of the results before we learn where they came from. So, here we go. I've already given you a number of results associated with the relation of the magnetic moment to the angular momentum. That's pleasant, only the question is, what does magnetic moment and what does angular momentum mean in quantum mechanics? In quantum mechanics, things like energy mean something, and momentum means something, but quantities like magnetic moment and so on do mean something, but it turns out best to define those in terms of the simple of other concepts such as energy and so on, in order to make sure that you know what it means. Now, it's easy to define magnetic moment in terms of energy, because the energy of a moment in a magnetic field is mu dot b in the classical theory. Therefore, we have taken the following definition in quantum mechanics. If we calculate the energy of a system in a magnetic field, and we find it depends on the magnetic field and it's proportional to the proportional to the field when you have a magnetic field on, then the coefficient is called the magnetic moment. However, we don't have to get so elegant at this level. We can still think of the magnetic moment in the ordinary to some extent in the classical sense. But we'll wait with that because we'll take next the angular momentum. Because angular momentum in quantum mechanics is as real as momentum and energy, angular momentum too. That is to say, it carries over into quantum mechanics to be a very definite and simple thing. So the first thing I would like to discuss then is angular momentum in quantum mechanics. What are the characteristics of what in quantum mechanics is called angular momentum? You see, when you go to a new kinds of laws, you can't just assume that each word is going to mean exactly the same thing. Now you say, oh, I know what angular momentum is. That's that thing such that when it changes, it makes a torque. What's a torque? And so forth. So we have to have new definitions of old quantity. It would therefore be legally best to call it by some other name, such as slangular momentum or quantangular momentum, something like that, see? Because it's the angular momentum in quantum mechanics. But if we can find a quantity in quantum mechanics which is unique for quantum mechanics, and that when the system is large enough is the same as the angular momentum, then there's no use inventing extra words. We might as well call it angular momentum. So with that understanding, this odd thing that I'm about to describe is angular momentum. It's the thing which, when the system is large, is what we recognize as angular momentum in classical mechanics. Does the following. Well, I first take a system in which angular momentum is conserved, such as an atom all by itself in empty space with central forces. Any system all by itself. You see, in a sense, with internal forces, a nucleus, K-meson, and a baseball. They all have angular momentum. They can have angular momentum. But we'll worry more about the non-baseball kind because it's where the quantum mechanics is more important. Now, with such a thing, in the ordinary sense, like the Earth spinning on its axis or something, you say, oh yeah, angular momentum, this object could be spinning around this axis or that axis or any other axis, and so there can be many states of the same energy. When a thing is spinning, it could, if it is spinning, has certain energy, but it could have another state of exactly the same energy by spinning in some other direction. And so we would have, if the thing had a finite angular momentum, according to classical theory, an infinite number of possible states, all of the same angular momentum, because the axis could be pointing in any direction. It turns out in quantum mechanics that the number of states of a system is limited, is finite. If the system is small, well, it's finite in any case. If the system is small, the finite number is very small, and if the system is large, the finite number gets very, very large. So I describe, it turns out the following, that if a system has angular momentum, let's take the Z component, for example. This is very mysterious, because why do I take the Z component? I will come back and discuss that question later. Please swallow this, and then we'll explain what it was that went down your throat later. The Z component of angular momentum cannot have any value whatever. It is true that for a system with a given energy, such as sodium in its first excited state, or a nucleus in the ground state, or a nucleus in an excited state of a definite energy, although I said a definite energy, I haven't completely defined the state because I have the analog of which direction the angular momentum is pointing. And it turns out that the Z component of angular momentum cannot point anywhere, cannot be arbitrary, but can only be one of a set of values which go like this. The largest is a certain number times h, the next one is one less, the next one is one less, and so on, until it's minus jh. That is, for each state of a system, there's a certain value of j. This numerical value of j is called the spin of the state definition. So for a state of spin J, the angular momentum along the z-axis, if measured, turns out to be either J times H or one less than that and so on down to minus J. You may be at least pleased to hear that it goes from plus to minus the same value, because at least I don't have to decide which direction the J-axis, the z-axis is. Certainly if I found out that it was from plus to minus a different amount, that would be infinitely mysterious, because I could have defined the z-axis the other way. So it's nice and symmetric. Now, if this is true, then if this must go down by integers to minus j, then j must be an integer. No, not quite. 2j must be an integer. If you think about it a while, the difference between these two n's must be an integer. So that j, in general, turns out to be either half integer or an integer. We'll talk about when you can expect it to be half integer, integer, and so on, probably in some other lecture, I hope. Now we'll just take these pieces of information. That is, for instance, if we have a nucleus like lithium, say, in which the spin is 3/2, that means that the angular momentum around the z-axis in units of h is either plus 3/2, plus 1/2, minus 1/2, or minus 3/2. If we have a system whose spin is 2, then the z component of angular momentum is 2, 1, 0, minus 1, or minus 2 times h cross only. That's what this says. There are, as a consequence of this, of course, if you count how many states there are 2j plus 1 possibilities. These are 2j plus 1 states, and these are all the states there are. That is, if you tell me the energy, and you know also the spin, then it turns out there are exactly 2j plus 1 states and that energy corresponding to all these different values of the z component. Also, I may add another fact, that if you pick up an atom at random, in other words, if somebody's been throwing them at you and they all have spin 3/2 and they're coming in at random, nobody's oriented the spin in any sense, and you measure the z component of the angular momentum, then, of course, you get all these values, but the thing is, you get them in equal likelihood. All these states are, in fact, single states that are just as good as any others. Each one of them has the same weight in the world. Incidentally, that has a simple classical analog. By the way, if you ask the same question classically, if I threw atoms, here's a z-axis, I threw atoms with axis in arbitrary directions, what is the probability of different components along the z-axis? Well, you know the probability is equal to be anywhere on the surface of a sphere. Equal areas on the surface of a sphere are equally likely. You may or may not know, and I'm telling you if you don't, that if you take a zone of a given thickness on the surface of a sphere, this zone, and you take the same thickness in other places, the area of the sphere here is the same. That means that the probability of having the z component be different value is uniform. And that checks with this. Each value is separated by the same amount, and each have the same weight. Incidentally, that tells us something else. That turns out very many times that people have guessed at the quantum mechanic, like to guess at the quantum mechanical formula by starting from the classical formulas. And I have to give you a rule by which such a guess can usually be made correctly. Not always. These things are just the guesses. Sometimes there's a thing that corresponds in the classical theory to the square of the J, the length of the J vector. I'd like to show you that this thing, in the classical theory, it's usual, most likely, can get the right answer to the corresponding quantum mechanical formula very often by replacing it by J times J plus 1, H square, and I'd like to prove that. J dot J would be JZ square plus JX square plus JY square. And if I got an object thrown at me at random, oh, the J dot J shouldn't depend upon, J dot J is a scalar. It has no dependence whatever on the direction of the spin. So this J dot J is the same for every one of these states, of course, because J dot J has no direction involved. So this is the same for every one of the states. But it's also these three. Now, if I were to take this averaging game, if the things were thrown at me at random, I would expect that if I were to make the measurements along the x-axis or the y-axis or the z-axis, it wouldn't make any difference. And so this thing should be three times the average that I would get for the z direction of the spin squared. Let me leave off an h to do the arithmetic. How do I calculate this? Well, I have j squared plus j minus 1 squared plus j minus 2 squared plus and so on, plus minus j square, all times h square, divided by how many things I have. I've already told you it's 2j plus 1. This is the average of jz square. You see, sometimes I get j square, and sometimes j minus 1, and so on for jz square. So the average value of jz square, when I've given the things at random, will be this. This denominator is because these are the total number of entries up here. So I only have to sum up that sum, from J, the sum of the squares of numbers like these. Here, let's try it on this one, for instance. J squared, this to find out what this is. It's 9/4. I get 9/4 for the square 1/4 of the time. I would get, what is the next one? 1/2. I get 1/4 for the square 1/4 of the time, another 1/4 and 1/4. And they would be 4 trials. 2j plus 1 is 4. And the average then is equal to 10/4, 10/2, 10/8, 5/4. Now I said it was j times j plus 1, and j is 3/2 here. And you see 3/2 times 3/2 plus 1 is 3/2 times this, 15/4. Yes, 15/4. Because jz square is only 5/4. But J square is the 3 times as big, which is 15/4. 15/4. I will leave up to you, those who like to do mathematics, the problem of summing the sum in general and to show that it's true not only for 3/2, but that this is a general rule, that you can sum that sum of in squares. But I'll let you play with the sum of squares. The next step now, after talking about the angular momentum, is to talk about the energy, the magnetic moment. And we'll take it as granted that this formula, whatever it means in quantum mechanics, is true. That's a funny statement. Whatever it means, it's true. Now, I now discuss the energy of a spinning system in an external magnetic field. The energy of an object which has a magnetic moment in an external field, and let's suppose the external field is along the z-axis, is plus or minus mu dot b. Does anybody know which way it is? If it's electric dipole, it's put it on the inside. See, 50-50. Look, you figure out the sign, something like this. Say, let's say minus. If it's wrong, you just change all the signs. Now, if the B is in the Z direction, that's the Z component of the magnetic moment. I left out, I made a mistake in sign. It's the Z component of the magnetic, I write every which way, you see, times B. If B is in the Z direction. But mu sub Z, and we're going to use this formula in the following sense, that mu in any direction, in any respect, for any kind of calculation, is equivalent to J multiplied by this factor. Well, let's take the atomic case, for example. So this thing would be, in the case of an atom, G times Q over 2m sub electron multiplied by the Z component of angular momentum times B. But the Z component of the magnetic of the angular momentum is not anything you want. It can only be these different values there, the J from plus JH to minus JH. And therefore, the energy of the system is not arbitrary, and it can't be anything at all, but can only be one of the following numbers. It could either be times J, or times J minus 1, or J minus 2, down to minus J. That is to say, the energy in a magnetic field of the state is no longer the energy it was without the magnetic field, but is modified by an extra term proportional to the field, but an amount which is different for the different J levels. In short, if this is the energy level, plotting energy vertically, when there's no magnetic field, then if we turn on a magnetic field, this thing will split into a lot of levels. For example, if J equals 3/2, into 4 levels, which are all equally spaced. You see, JZ is equally spaced. From a plus value up here to a minus. And in fact, I've drawn the case. This is the state with JZ equal plus 3/2, plus 1/2, minus 1/2, and minus 3/2. The signs may be reversed, as we've had an error in the sign in the beginning. The energy, then, is the magnetic field times these various integers. And that's the characteristic of the behavior of an atomic system in a magnetic field. For example, if it's a single electron with spin 1/2, then there are 2 levels only, because I forgot to say that, didn't I? Example, a single electron has a J corresponding to 1/2 and a G corresponding to 2. So for a single electron, there are 2 states alone. If there were no orbital motion or any other angular momentum, just the spin of the electron, then in a magnetic field, the state would be split open, and the energies would be plus and minus for the 2 cases, plus 1/2 and minus 1/2, of 2, because that's G, and then QH over 2M electron times, well, let me put it this way, 2, this is a plus or minus 1/2 is a 2 possibility. This quantity here is the dimensions of a magnetic moment, because if the energy in a field is a magnetic field times a moment. So in classical physics, the energy would be mu b if it were lined up, and minus mu b if it were lined up down. And we could say then that this thing corresponds to this, that the spin of an electron can be either up or down, that when it's up, it has an up magnetic moment equal to QH over 2m electron, which is a number which comes up so often in the quantum mechanics. It's a unit of magnetic moment for atoms. It's called the Bohr magneton, this is called, because it's a unit that's very convenient for magnetic moments in quantum mechanics. But we then have that the magnet, the spin of the electron carries this much magnetic moment, and the magnet can either be up or down. That's too special a case. You must watch out. Because when the angular momentum of a system is higher, It isn't either up or down, but it's full up, cockeyed slightly, backwards and upside down, depending on the values of J. But the case of the electron is simple. There are just the two possibilities, up and down. Now, I evidently have not discussed the paramagnetism of substances, and the time is up, but this lecture is complicated enough that we will continue again in the same subject next time. That's a lot of stuff. Well, the classical theory is not so important, but the quantum mechanical stuff, yes.
Yeah, but is it important enough just to give us all this mess of stuff? What are we going to do with it?
Learn it.
Really?
Certainly.
From this?
Yes.
I don't expect us to learn this.
You just memorize it.
For what reason?
Because it's true.
You memorize things just because they're true? I can't see that this is going to help us much.
In doing what?
Well, that's the question. What are we supposed to be doing in this course?
We're learning about nature. This is the behavior of nature. What am I supposed to do?
Well, I can think of a lot of other things you might do.
What?
Like, you might carefully explain what the classical mechanics expects.
But the classical mechanics... But what's the point of... I did, firstly, the classical mechanics, and it gives the wrong answers. So what's the use? I did go slowly enough. I don't think that the stuff on the classical mechanics was so complicated. First, how about this one? That the magnetic moment is proportionally angular momentum?
Okay, you did all right at the very beginning.
Well, when did I lose you?
You lost me when you asked us to prove that theorem.
Well, forget it. Just remember the theorem, that the classical mechanics is a failure. What I'm trying to prove to you is that the classical mechanics is no good for the subject. That's all you have to remember. Look, you want to know what to learn? Look at the summary if you're worried about that you can't understand everything. This is a very exciting and interesting theorem. It's just a hint as to how the heck it works. The other one with the Coriolis force, you didn't follow because you forgot about Coriolis force. Some guy might remember it, then for him it's of some interest. These are historical items which are not the description of nature, and those are not the thing to learn. Because they don't describe nature correctly.
But they're simpler, and we've got to
but
learn
may be
things first.
Why learn stupid things that are wrong first? Because they're simple.
Why never learn anything? Because you have something that's too difficult to see.
If you wanted to talk about the magnetic moments of a big object and you could get it from the classical physics, it's all right, but you're learning something that isn't true. It's simple, but it isn't true. This stuff is true, and it's not complicated. It's just unusual. The fact, for instance, that the component of the angular momentum has these values is something you're going to have to memorize now, because I can't prove this to you.
Something we can't understand doesn't mean anything to us. Even if we memorize it, it's not going to...
Nobody understands it, you damn fool. Nobody understands it. This is a fact that nobody understands. You can get more complicated arguments. I will later tell you an argument by which... You see, what's bothering you is you've been taught a certain order. You've been taught a certain way. And now I want to teach you a different way. And every mind in this room's got a different way of entering subjects. There are some guys who can't stand it. Where did all those equations come from, those Maxwell equations from which everything gets deduced? First explain to me about electrostatics, and I'll understand the Maxwell equation. Same way in reverse. Suppose for a guy like that, I'd start with the Schrodinger equations and all the stuff with the operators and everything of angular momentum, and then I would deduce this thing. How could he follow? He wouldn't know what the operators meant. And what I'm trying to deduce, another guy can remember a certain fact. It isn't hard to remember. He just has a block against it psychologically because he says, I don't understand where it comes from. Nobody really understands where it comes from. They can put it in seven different ways. You can put, but there's always something in the quantum mechanics than where it comes from. We don't understand, because where does nature come from? It's not feasible for you. It would be much more difficult for you if I were to try to present to you a mathematical machinery from which this laws would come. These are so much easier to understand than the way, than any derivation from some other position, that it's an effectively worthwhile thing to learn it. Certainly there is, but sooner or later, no matter what happened to you, you would have to learn this before you learned all the mathematics that produced it. Sooner or later in your career, somebody would tell you this before, and if they didn't, you'd never understand what the guys were talking about when they have these operators which don't commute, that jx, jy minus jy, jx equals I over h.
Why now, though? Why runs through the whole of physics before we even get to it?
This is simple.
It's simple to write. Yes.
That's right, and it's simple, therefore, to learn.
If you like.
What's hard about it?
I thought learning was getting knowledge, not
it is.
Getting gunk that you memorize.
That's knowledge, too.
Is it?
There are several different ways of finding out that something is true. One is by remembering great fundamental principles from which everything is deduced. Other things by remembering certain pieces of information from which things are being deduced. This is a piece of information about the world. This is just as true as anything else I told you. I could give you Maxwell's equations, or I can give you Gauss's law. Both are correct. And I can give you the fundamental laws with matrices, and I can give you the consequences of that. That's also correct. The reason that I have a right to teach you this is because it's true, as far as we know experimentally. I will present you some experiments next time by which this has been demonstrated. Would that help any?
Yes.
All right. Then we'll do that. But I first have to describe what you expect to happen in the experiments, and then show how it fits
with
the...
That's all right, but if you can show us some basis, you see this... Just writing it all on the board is very difficult to understand, because
well,
I don't have any basis at all for it. I don't have any idea what's going on. And I don't know.
I know.
Students in general like to have the feeling that at least they understand somewhat what's going on.
They cannot understand this.
All right, then explain that carefully next time.
I did. I said it comes from quantum mechanics. And I said in the thing, I said,
people who know,
I said to you in the lecture, I said that it's our usual method to start from the fundamental laws and to deduce the consequences. That to deduce this from the laws of quantum mechanics is to go too far ahead. That we're not going to take up quantum mechanics in that order, and therefore I have to give you some rules, some results of it.
Now,
want me to say that again? I'll say it again.
All right, say it again.
Okay.
But I have a question.
Right.
Are we going to be able to use this?
Yes.
We've memorized it?
Yes.
Doing what?
Just figuring some things out. For instance, finding the paramagnetic energy of a paramagnetic susceptibility of a gas, for instance, or of a substance. How strong a piece of substance is attracted to a magnet?
Have we seen everything else that there is to use to electromagnetic theory?
Yes. No. Yes.
Yeah.
Except for the properties of materials. And now we have to talk about the properties of materials, and materials involve quantum mechanics. There's nothing else to electricity and magnetism to learn, unless you want to learn how stuff will behave. No, you've taken everything there is to learn about electricity and magnetism, with the single exception of the stress, the formula for stresses in the field, which I had put in the tensor lecture, but left it out because I ran out of time. With that exception, you've learned everything there is to know in electricity and magnetism, and now we have to learn about the properties of materials. Look, it isn't so difficult. Don't make such a psychological pling out of it. It's all here on one blackboard. Just learn it. Remember, someday when you're smarter, you'll find out why it's true. Put it into your head this way. That's the most goddamn the curious thing I ever learned. Isn't it peculiar? Someday I'm going to try to figure out how in the hell that's the... And furthermore, someday I'm going to teach better than that guy did, because I'm going to figure out a way that when I explain it to the class, they're going to understand the reason for it.
All right.
So take it that way. Take it as a challenge instead of as a thing to fight. Say, this is a lousy way to present it. When I teach, I'm going to present it a better way, But of course, I have to remember this thing temporarily because that's the way the stinker showed it to me. And what I need to do is to learn later how, watch carefully, how the hell it's derived. Because actually you can derive it in a very beautiful way, and it is an elementary thing, and I debated with myself whether to derive it in that way. But I feel that the idea of amplitudes in quantum mechanics is enough foreign to you, you're not used to it enough, that if I tried to deduce it from that, you would get somewhat unhappy. Also, you'd be stuck either way. It's bad luck, but this result is simpler than the derivations.
Well, thank you for being...
Yes, sir. I'm not really patient, as you see. But try that way. Try not to fight it, because if you fight it, you're going to have a hole in your education. Well, you know what I mean? You'll leave that out, and you'll leave it out whenever you hear it, and you'll get worse and worse as time goes on, because nobody's going to present it to you the other way around for a long time.
It's just that I find that so many times, if I don't attempt to understand something and don't know what's going on, then it's really useless to me.
I know, but
as soon as I have to apply it, I don't know.
The trouble is that the quantum mechanics is different than the classical mechanics, and some of the differences merely have to be learned. They cannot be intuited, mm-hmm. because they're not in your background experience. You can't say, oh, if I can't understand, I kind of feel a baseball goes this way. And when and you can feel some things, but you can't feel that, because that's too small. And nobody feels it, so they can deduce it analytically. But from what? From something else that's hard to understand by complicated mathematics. I can't help it.
Okay, thanks.
I can't help it.